Hey everyone, it's Katie Couric, and I want to tell you about one of my new favorite podcasts. It's called A Really Good Cry with the amazing Roddy Devlukia, a plant-based chef, entrepreneur, and now a podcast host who will guide you through a journey of self-discovery, one tear at a time. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Roddy Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go, right? There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. On NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's part existential deep dive and part game show. I ask actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to ask some of life's biggest questions. Listen to NPR's Wildcard on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Hi, Katie.
Hi, Brian. Well, today's episode, everyone, has a very fun origin story. It all started with afternoon tea, but of course.
Which we do daily.
Yeah, sure.
Remember our series of London episodes back in June? Well, while we were there, we had to sneak away from work to have some finger sandwiches and a pot of tea. And we thought, what better place to do it than at this amazing hotel called Claridge's, which has a very rich and storied history.
And an elegant tea, by the way. And that's where we ran into today's guests, Simon Doonan and Jonathan Adler. They were sitting, remember, Ryan, right near us at another table. And I was so excited to see these fellow Americans in the middle of Claridge's. I had met them both before, but we got reacquainted over scones and clotted cream. And we decided, hey, why don't you come be on our podcast?
We just book everywhere we go.
Yes.
Anyway, not to mention, Katie, they're quite a style power couple. Simon has been called the world's most famous window dresser. For years, he made the whimsical and witty window displays for Barney's, where he currently works as their creative ambassador at large. I would love that job at some point.
I want that title. I just don't want the large part.
Creative ambassador at Trim, at Svelte. Anyway, Jonathan, meanwhile, is a Potter turned housewares guru. He's known for his namesake brand and the line of boutiques that he runs, which sell bold and modern home goods around the world.
And Brian, we've been talking for some time about wanting to have some couples on the pod. What can I say? I'm a romantic at heart, but they are a very cute couple.
And a very successful one. They seem to have a really happy dynamic, and they've been together for many years. So today is our first time having a couple guests together on the show. And before we get to our conversation with Simon and Jonathan, we have a quick announcement. Katie, you know what they say about best laid plans?
Yes, of mice and men, they often go awry.
That they do. Some of our listeners may recall that at the end of last week's episode, we mentioned our plans for a two-part audio documentary series marking the 10-year anniversary of Katie's interviews with Sarah Palin.
Those docs are still in the works, ladies and gentlemen, but the series is going to start next week instead of this week because we're still fine-tuning the episodes. We want them to really shine. What can I say? We're perfectionist people.
We hope you like them once you can eventually listen to them.
Now, in the meantime, we're very excited to bring you this week's episode, The Dynamic Duo of Simon and Jonathan. So we thought we'd start by asking you about how you met. It was in 1994. It was on a blind date. So set the scene. Simon, why don't you start?
Well, a friend of mine said to me, very en passant, as the French say, you should go on a date with Jonathan Adler. And I thought, oh, yeah, that'd be fun. I vaguely knew who he was. We were already selling his ceramics at Barney's at the time where I was working. And so a lot of people think Johnny kind of shagged his way into Barney's. But I'm here to tell you, he didn't.
He didn't sleep his way to the top floor.
That's a prettier way of saying it. And then so we made a date. And
yeah, we made a blind date. And it's funny, the friend who set us up said to me, oh, you should date Simon Doonan. And at the time, I was like a kind of bohemian clay spattered potter. And Simon was Miss Thing fashion superstar juggernaut. And I thought, you know, this is going to be an oil and water situation. Like, I'm too gritty and crunchy and real, and he's too Miss Thing. Cut to, now, 24 years later, I can tell you the truth, which is that we did a complete bait and switch. I am totally like a little fancy pants Miss Thing, and Simon's actually quite crunchy and bohemian. So I think, like, in many relationships, like, the old bait and switch happened big time.
And you were, by the way, Simon, a bit of a cougar. I can relate to that because you were 42 and Jonathan was 28 when you all met.
Yeah. And the weird thing is we'd never thought about it that much. The bigger difference was he was on rollerblades and covered in clay and carrying a backpack. And I was an executive vice president of creative services at Barney's. I had a corporate job. So that was a bigger difference than the age difference. And I remember us going out running and I could run faster than him. Stuff like that.
That is ancient history. But you hold on to that, little buddy. You hold on to that.
So Jonathan bothered you with a lot of direct questions, I read.
Yes.
He sort of looked into your eyes and just started quizzing you.
Definitely. Like, Johnny was asked me almost like an HR interview, like, so, blah, 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 and asked me questions. And
which you answered monosyllabically and just sat there. So, of course, I had no choice but to continue the interview.
Sounds like a great date.
I'd be like, so, do you have any siblings? She's like, yeah, I have a sister.
Yes.
Crickets. And I'm like, okay. Well, and then who's your favorite
parent?
That
was a cultural thing. Like, you know, Johnny's background, Jewish, creative. You know, his family, they don't stop talking. My family, I don't remember them starting talking. You know, like that was very much a cultural thing. And I don't mean that in a critical way.
In fact, you all both come from fairly unconventional families. And that's one of the things I think that brought you together. Very different unconventional families. But Jonathan, describe your family. You grew up in New Jersey.
I grew up in New Jersey, but not New Jersey, New Jersey. I grew up in like a little tiny farm town 3 hours outside of New York called Bridgeton, that's very kind of in the middle of nowhere, quite remote, rural, but not picturesque. I'm just keeping it 100. Sorry, Bridgeton, if you're listening. And yeah, my family was sort of Jewish, intellectual. My mother like was living in New York and working for Vogue when she met my dad. And they got married, and he said, all right, darling, we're going to go to my hometown. And so they were kind of fish out of water, my whole family was. And, yeah, my dad spent all of his life making art in the basement of our groovy modern house, and my mom is sort of a creative person. So it was a very strange and remote childhood. And I am, you know, I was gay living in rural America, and one day I discovered pottery, and that was that. And that kind of really was my refuge from rural America.
What about your siblings?
We're all the same, actually. I have two older siblings who are both, they got the brains in the family. They went to like Columbia and Yale, and they're both hyper intellectual. And my sister's a law professor at NYU. My brother's like an economist and an artist. So we're all freaks.
Yes, but speaking of freaks, we move now to Simon's family. And you called them the Addams family. You had this insane description of your childhood in the rooming house. Can you give our audience some of that color?
Well, I've written a few books that have a lot of autobiographical material in them. And I guess I had a choice. I could have written it like a misery memoir, or I wrote it through the lens of humor, which I think psychologically is easier for me than, you know, the painful bits. But basically, my parents were that generation that Tom Brokaw called the great generation, right? They were
the greatest.
Greatest. Like, they left, my mom left school at 13. My dad left school at 15. They joined the Royal Air Force subsequently. And at the end of the war, they met in a soup kitchen because they'd both run away from home. So they both couldn't go home. So they met in a soup kitchen. They had me and my sister pretty quickly, and we lived in a two-room flat, no kitchen and bathroom. After the war, people didn't have anything. There was no reparation money coming to England. So it was like squalid, but my mother always says that was the most happiest time. And then...
But just to set the scene a little bit, your grandmother who'd had a lobotomy lived on the bottom floor.
Well, no, you're jumping ahead.
Oh, but sorry.
We got
sorry.
To the right... That's the right juncture, because we lived in this very small attic. And then my grandmother, who had had a lobotomy, came out of the institution, and she... had some cash somehow, enough to buy this rambling old house. And we all moved in there, and it became a sort of rooming house for our various relatives and lodgers. And that's where I spent most of my childhood.
Schizophrenic Uncle Ken lived on the second floor.
Yes, there was a lot of mental illness. My grandfather had committed suicide. My uncle committed suicide. Like, it's a lot of alcoholism, mental illness.
I mean, it actually does sound a bit like the island of misfit toys. On the other hand, it's a very serious thing that you were surrounded by people who had these issues. And I'm curious how you were able, Simon, to just kind of stay focused and
emerge
move
from
forward.
That.
Yeah.
Well, I give my parents a lot of credit for that. They had very strong personalities. They're extremely resilient. You know, my sister and I are both gay. You know, and back then, you didn't come out to your parents. You didn't talk about it. You just fled as soon as you could. And the best way to do it was to go to college, because if your parents didn't have any money, the government would pay for you to go to college. And I thought, great. So I was like an insanely diligent student for my A-levels. And I got into Manchester University. And that was how you got out. Then you start to reinvent yourself, find out who you are, and blah, blah, blah. It's the 1960s, self-discovery, you know, gay liberation, blah, blah, blah. So that was sort of my
gay liberation, blah, blah, blah. And how did your folks, when you realized that you were gay, and your sister as well, Simon, that was a time when it wasn't embraced, much less accepted. So what was that like for you, that experience?
Well, I vividly remember, like, realizing I was gay, and very quickly I realized, oh, it's also illegal. And I think my dad was sort of seeing which way the wind was blowing. And he said to me, oh, yeah, those homosexuals, you know, they all get put in prison or they get blackmailed or blah, blah, blah.
You mean he sensed it?
Yeah. And he was trying to put me off going in that direction. But I was always reading magazines, you know, and I was always looking to the horizon to see, oh, the beautiful people on the horizon living groovy lives in London. And I would read about these swinging 60s people like Robert Fraser and Christopher Gibbs and the Stones and Marianne Faithfull. And I was like, oh, I want some of that. I could see on the horizon where no one cared what you were, you know, the emerging counterculture, the emerging culture of the swinging 60s. I could see it within screaming distance. And we lived not far from London. So I was like getting on the train and going, or hitching up to Carnaby Street and thinking, yeah, these are my people, fashion people, gay people, flamboyant people. So I saw an escape route.
And what about you, Jonathan? I mean, by the way, you know, you went to Brown. It's not like you're the black sheep of the family, incidentally, in terms of your intellect. But was it challenging for you as a young gay man in Bridgeton, New Jersey?
Of course it was. I'll tell you all about it. First, I just want to mention, like, it's when Simon was talking about his childhood, the Dickensian nature of his childhood is so startling. And I was just laughing because I was thinking about when I was talking about our first meeting and how I thought, oh, he's Little Miss Fancy Pants, you know, fashionista, little realizing the Dickensian backstory and what that little fella had accomplished. Yes, of course. Growing up gay, yeah, of course it was very challenging. And, you know, I knew, as most gay men do, quite early that I was gay. It was like I knew immediately. And I think, you know, there's...
I think it wasn't that different. Weirdly, you know, even though there's a big age difference, you didn't walk into some utopia where everybody was all gay positive. It was weirdly, you know, dissimilar.
Yeah, no, there was no way I could have been out as a gay. Like, that was not...
Even at Brown in those days?
Well, at Brown, some people were, but you'd be shocked how many of my friends from Brown came out after college. Hmm. I graduated in 88, and of course people were out, but it was still strangely difficult. And when I think about why gay people are as creative as gay people are, which I think is one of the great mysteries of gayness, like, why are our people so creative? And I'm not the most spiritual person, but part of me just thinks like maybe that's what we are put on earth for. But another part of me thinks that the gay experience is growing up and kind of operating on two levels simultaneously. And I think it really sharpens your senses. So, you know, one has to sort of go through life as if you're going through life and go through all the motions, which you are, but you're also aware the whole time that you're sort of hiding something and there's something inauthentic. And of course, that's challenging. But I think the flip side of it is that it kind of makes you a little bit sharper and perhaps, you know, one has to live a slightly more vivid fantasy life as a gay. And maybe that's the source of gay creativity. I don't know. It's something I think about a lot. And
it is interesting.
It's weird.
When you think about some of the most brilliant people in the history of the world and their contributions, so many of them were gay.
Yeah. We're like a creative
Liberace
set.
Yeah, that's exactly who she was thinking
Liberace.
Of. You nailed it.
I mean,
it.
I was thinking of Michelangelo, right? And yeah. Or Leonardo da Vinci, one of them.
Oscar Wilde.
Who was
Oscar,
it?
I was thinking of Oscar Wilde. I don't know whether it was Da Vinci.
Is it Da Vinci or Michelangelo or both?
Yeah.
We'll take both.
So can we ask you a question about your relationship that I think would apply both to gay couples and straight couples? I read, and you can correct if this is wrong, that you basically haven't had any commitment issues, that you bought a house together or you rent an apartment together 18 months in. How did you two just clap eyes on each other and know this is it and make it work all these years?
We just had really low expectations.
Yeah. I was like, oh, he'll do. Actually,
that's
it is
beautiful.
It's a little bit of a real
Does anyone have a tissue?
Story. Yeah. This is very New York. So Sliman had just bought this fabulous apartment when I first met him. And it was an apartment that was kind of legendary. And I had always noticed it. And when I found out he bought it, I was like, oh, you'll do. And that was
so
that.
It was really about the nice apartment.
It was 100% about the apartment.
You didn't
save this story for
your vows when you got married because it's just so heartwarming. Amazing.
No, like many New Yorkers, it was 100% a real estate play.
You know, I love the fact that you both have created this life based on your creativity. And I'm fascinated by how people choose a career or are lucky enough to turn their passion into their profession.
Every morning I get up and I thank the Lord that I was able to have a job where I was able to do stuff that I found creatively stimulating. And that, and even my corporate years of Barney's, it was always stimulating. It was always creative. I was involved in so much stuff. And I never took that for granted because the town I grew up in, it was like the local factories. That's where you worked. And I did do that in the summers. And so I saw what that was like. So to have a job where you're consumed with passion, even if it's just making paper mache props for a window, but you're having fun, you're like, you care about it. Like, that is such a gift.
And you have a vision for what you're doing. How did you tap into that? How did you discover what would give you joy?
It was quite specific, actually. I moved to London after college and I worked in stores. You know, that's what everybody did back then. If they weren't sure what to do, they got a job in a store. So selling fashion.
When they had stores, right?
Yeah.
Like, oh, yeah. Remember that?
Back in the good old days.
Remember those? Remember stores?
And I used to watch the window display people and I thought, well, they're busy all day. Their work day isn't contingent on customers coming in. So I thought, I could do that. It doesn't seem that complicated. So then I got a job at Aquascutum.
Remember that.
Oh, I love Aquascutum. Great, British outerwear and umbrella company.
A little frumpy, but very.
I don't think so.
Whereas what the
classical,
queen,
traditional.
What the queen wears when she's out with the corgis and the Heather Aquascutum. So it was great because the windows were very elaborate. And I was a schlep. You know, I was carrying ladders, paint, carrying the mannequins, stuff like that. And
I loved it, as they said in London in the 1970s.
Exactly. And then for extra cash, I used to go into smaller boutiques and say, oh, who does your window? I'm a window dresser. I'll give me £5 and I'll do your window once a month. So I had a lot of these freelance jobs. And one of them was quite noteworthy. It was a store on Savile Row, and it was the first trendy tailor on Savile Row called Tommy Nutter. And Tommy Nutter, N-U-T-T-E-R, he was this legendary guy who was the first one to take those old Savile Row idea and make it trendy. So he made Mick Jagger's wedding suit when Mick married Bianca and he's wearing the white. Mm-hmm. He made clothes for Elton John and and the people from that era. So they wanted fun, crazy windows. So that is when I started to do things where I'd put like a coffin in the window with a mannequin in it. Or like, you know, I found all these little stuffed rats and made little tuxedos for them. And they wanted things that were edgy and sort of a little more punk rock. And that's when I tapped into like, oh, like if you do something unconventional, you'll get attention. People will like it. You'll get more work and da, da, da. And one day, this guy, this incredible guy called Tommy Purse, he came in and he said, oh, you should come work for me in L.A. So I was 25 and I just got on a plane and went to live in L.A. when I was 25.
And what did you do for Tommy Purse?
I dressed his windows at his store, which was then, it was called Maxfield. Uh-huh. And it's still there.
Which is an iconic L.A. boutique.
Because Brian's from L.A.
Yeah, well, yes. You may not remember, but it used to be next to the Troubadour.
I do remember that, actually.
And I did those windows with these vintage mannequins that Tommy collected. And I was, that's where I had my swinging, degenerate, crazy 20s, was mostly in L.A.
Do you believe that you were in some ways responsible for changing or transforming what was considered sort of window dressing into a real art form?
Well, there was a group of people who were doing that. Some of them are still around, like Linda Fargo from Bergdorf. So Candy Pratt's Price from Vogue used to do these crazy punk rock windows at Bloomingdale's. So there was, it was a movement of, because windows are great because they're democratic. Everyone sees them. You can really communicate to a lot of people. So I was one of several people. And unfortunately, many of the great ones died of AIDS. I mean, I could sit here listing them all, and it's Colin Birch, Bob Benzio. There was a ton of great people who in the early 80s, they died of AIDS. So Linda and I often say, God, if all those people had stuck around, maybe would we have gotten our moment? Would we have? Because there were so many talented people.
It's so interesting, too, to me, because here's this art form that's so ephemeral, but also, as you said, so democratic, a way to gather community. I love looking at people, looking at windows.
The sad thing is windows have kind of become less relevant than they used to be. Like when I first moved to New York and Simon's windows were so legendary, there'd be like people thronged on the streets waiting for the reveal. And that was, of course, before cell phones. Now that kind of democracy and shared experience of windows seems to be disappearing.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, people are looking at their phones.
Oh, that's
true. Or they're just taking the picture of the window so they can share it on social media and not actually.
Although
immersing.
I still do see people around the holidays.
Yeah, holiday windows
around,
are that.
You know, Bloomingdale's and Saks and, of course, Barney's. And then from the window dressing, and then, Jonathan, we're going to get to your sort of career in a second, but from the window dressing, you went, it allowed you to branch out in incredible ways.
Well, when I did my book, Peter Kaplan, who is the editor of the New York Observer, he said to me, oh, your book is funny. You should come write a column for us. So during the day, I was working at Barney's, and then I'd go home and bang out this weekly column for the New York Observer. And Peter Kaplan was just one of those very special people in the newspaper world.
Didn't Jared Kushner fire him?
Yeah. I'm not quite sure how that played out, but Jared Kushner ended up buying the Observer, yes.
And did you work at all under Jared Kushner?
Under isn't the preposition I would use. Because, you know, he owned the paper, so I was one of many people just banging out their column and sending it in. And we overlapped there, but I would see him at the Christmas party.
You, I know, Jonathan, encouraged Simon to write that column because you said, you've got to do this.
I hate to give Simon compliments, and
clearly,
IRL, I typically do not. However, I will keep it real in this thing. Simon is a bizarre polymath who is visually extraordinarily gifted, but can write like no one else. And it's like, I think it might be an English thing where there are other English people who are like prominent in one field who suddenly can pick up a pen and really turn a phrase. Like, believe it or not, Joan Collins, like I've read some of her writing, and it's just very sharp and quick. And Simon's like one of those English people who just manages to capture his cheeky voice in writing. And it's,
can I make a sweeping generalization about
sure.
the English? I
yes.
think that you all value writing and talking and language and diction a lot more than Americans do. I think
you're really over enunciating when you're saying this, Brian.
I am sorry, Katie, if this is awkward.
No,
I think you're sort of informally trained in it based on the way you are educated and talk to your peers, and therefore most British people I know are really good talkers and writers.
My theory is that America is an incredibly playful culture. Like the first thing you see when I moved to LA was like people stretching at a bus stop or bouncing a ball, like like in pink tights, you know, like
that may be sort of
West
Hollywood thing.
Playful, very playful culture. But when people get into print, they get very formal, like I'm writing an essay now and blah, blah, blah. Whereas England is an incredibly formal culture historically, structurally, and when they get into print they just don't care. Like that's when your only obligation is to be entertaining. So like going to the pub, your only obligation is to make people laugh and tell funny stories. So there's like a lot of cultural stuff that I think makes English people that have that sort of witty, loose panache with words that, you know, someone
with
like,
the education to back it up, though, generally, right?
Yeah, like a Tina Brown.
Or not know. Even. Like it's, I think often, you know, the cab drivers who are Cockney East London people have the best gift of gab. But on the English tip, back to our relationship for one sec, I think one of the reasons we ended up together is that English people really like to take the piss out of each other. Like they tease each other ruthlessly and relentlessly as a sign of affection. And that's how I've always rolled. But Americans don't typically do that. I think Americans, don't you think people in America
we're more
don't,
delicate?
Yeah, like we don't make fun of each other ruthlessly and immediately.
Oh, I do.
Good.
Yeah.
We need to
working
hang
with
more.
This one.
Time for us to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to help Simon and Jonathan remember when their wedding anniversary is. That's right after this.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on
this. People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in
exactly.
to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy,
right.
which is different than empathy,
yeah.
right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already yeah. see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together, we'll cry together, and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go, right? There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. On NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's part existential deep dive and part game show. I ask actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to ask some of life's biggest questions. Listen to NPR's Wildcard on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from The Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And now back to our conversation with Simon Doonan and Jonathan Adler.
Jonathan, you've built an extraordinary career out of your passion as well. You decided to become a potter at 27. You left your job. What were you doing and why did you decide to leave it?
Well, so I had always wanted to be a potter. From the second I touched clay as a kid, I like had a instant love affair with clay.
By the way, do you guys ever reenact that scene from Ghost?
Oh, nightly, I'm sure.
In the beginning, we used to do. In the beginning of our relationship, we'd be like, "Let's do the ghost."
And now, wedging.
It happens less and less frequently. I'm sorry to say.
we should dub in that music right now.
Oh my love,
totes.
My darling.
No, we always have that in the But our 45 is getting a bit scratchy, and it's on repeat. So, I always wanted to be a potter, and I always wanted to be a Jap. Like, I needed to be...
So you needed to be a rich potter.
Yes, but that seemed absolutely impossible. So I tried to work in the movie business after college, and
luckily, did you study at Brown, by the way?
I studied semiotics and art history. Oh. So I didn't have a practical bone in my body. I was completely airy-fairy and impractical, and that really showed itself in the workplace, where I got fired from about 5 jobs in a row, real news, for... Like, I slept with everybody in the office, and I took personal calls, and finally I was sleeping with my boss, and then, you know, I broke up with him, and he fired me. And I was unemployed for, like, a year, and I couldn't find a job, and I started teaching night classes at a pottery studio in Hell's Kitchen, just while I was kind of trying to get a job. And no jobs were coming my way, and my parents finally were like, you're 27, you, like, went to an Ivy League college, and you're not making a dime, like... Sell a pot. And so I am, which seemed quite reasonable.
You didn't have a pot to piss in?
No. Yeah.
Sorry.
I just had a bunch of pots.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Too many pots, none sold.
Yes. Yes.
And so I ended up getting in touch with a buyer at Barney's and I got an order. And I thought, wow.
But this was after or before you guys got together?
Before we got together.
This was in 1993.
93. Stay with us here,
okay.
Barney. Come on. Stay here.
I'm riveted. I'm sorry.
So I got this order and I started to like make pots and I still just thought of myself as unemployed, but I got more orders. And then I kind of very gradually figured it out and realized that I had gone from kind of being really unemployable to being highly self-employed.
And this pretty extraordinary entrepreneur. You saw that your pots were popular in Barney's, and then you opened up your first retail store 5 years later. Now there are how many stores in all, Jonathan?
We have about 15 stores.
15 stores across the country.
Yeah, and 2 in London.
You know, a lot of artists, I think, it's probably an unfair generalization, but they don't necessarily have a brain for business, as they would say in Working Girl. But you actually... did. How did you translate your artistic skills into business skills?
I had maybe the worst mind for business of anyone in the history of our planet. And Simon can attest to that. I was like very ill-equipped. I didn't know what an invoice was. I was like completely incompetent. I just loved to make stuff. And like we didn't go into this with any sort of business plan or any ideas at all. And I think that that's not really how people today typically approach their careers. Like they all, you know, kind of want to be a brand from day one. I think both Slime and I kind of just figured it out. And I think that's something we very
nice
much have in common.
That's such a nice term of endearment, isn't it, Slime?
That's one of the more safe for work kind of appellations. So I just figured it out, as did Simon. I think we both also, like, Simon and I both work in very reviled professions, like Simon's a window dresser and I'm a potter. They're not exactly the most sizzling careers.
I beg to differ. I mean, I would see you both as being in very Tony professions.
Well, I think that's probably how they work now. But at the time, I mean, before you both hit it big, the notion that you would have these great, successful careers in those two professions, I mean, probably doubtful at best.
Yeah, because I thought... one of Johnny's best friends is Liz Lang, the maternity queen.
Liz Lang maternity. I used to wear her maternity clothes on the Today Show.
Oh, I love it.
And we, the three of us in the 90s, we used to talk about how hilarious it was that she was in maternity wear, he was a potter, I was a window dresser, because these were not you know, that was like being a fluffer in a strip club or something like that. It was like...
Yeah, like being the world's best fluffer.
Yeah. it was sort of almost like... I'll give you an example. Like, say, helicopter parents on the Upper East Side, they're spending a fortune on their helicoptering their kid and da-da-da-da-da. And the kid comes home and says, I want to be a window dresser. The parents probably go into crisis meetings with the counselors. Like, because it is one of those sort of joke professions.
Well, I think it predates this whole preoccupation with quote-unquote lifestyle brands, right? I mean, this whole burgeoning industry, whether it's through Instagram or Pinterest, this whole thing exploded kind of exactly the right time for both of you in a way. Mm. I mean, I feel like Simon more fashion and that was a constant. But for you, Jonathan, it's become this whole new field.
Well, I think we both saw it as sort of white space. Oh, here's an arena which isn't oversubscribed to, which people tend to steer a bit clear of. Because it has all these sort of déclassé associations. So, and Liz has talked that way. She was the first person to go into maternity. You know, like Karl Lagerfeld wasn't doing a maternity line. Like, maternity's seen as being, well, it's not like the...
It was like pee in the pod. That's where I shopped. And then Liz Lang came along, and I was like, hallelujah.
Right, Liz, it was like she revolutionized this kind of dusty... thing and made it like sexy and great
and chic.
Chic. Yeah. Chic, chic, chic. And she just had this incredible vision.
Yeah, I think she saw a white space, like no one's doing that.
And so I reckon if you're like young and trying to figure it out, I think that's always a good way to think about it. Like, what is nobody doing?
That's always what I recommend to Biz Stone when I put together this book of advice. He said, find a need and fill it. Mm. I mean, it's almost that simple. Like, where is the white space? And how does that intersect with something that I love, which is also incredibly important, right, Jonathan?
Yeah, totally.
Or Johnny.
Or Johnny. I think the funny thing is, though, neither of us, like, we were both so bumbling and unstrategic that I don't think any of us knew the word white space until, like, a week ago. You know, we kind of just,
You didn't iterate for a long time?
There was no iteration or planning. Uh-huh. I think we just both happened to be very, very passionate about a particular thing, and somehow it all worked. And I think people now, with this idea of personal branding and everyone wanting to be a brand, and I'm a brand, he's a brand, they all think it's attainable, and people are all told to, like, follow your dream and it'll work out. And the truth is, it really won't. It just won't. Like, everybody who thinks they can follow their dream and it'll work out is incorrect. Like, in as much as mine has
remind
worked out.
Remind me not to hire you as a commencement speaker.
Don't ever hire me as a commencement speaker.
I actually think
speaker.
It's good advice, because most of the people who try to be brands just based on nothing, I think, fail. I think many of the brands, with the notable exception of the Kardashians, are actually... you know, there because they're doing something, accomplishing something, filling a need.
Yeah, but there's also, for everyone who breaks through and is accomplishing something, there's a million more who are more talented who haven't broken through. So there's just such a huge element of luck and
timing.
Timing. And so really, you know, Andy Warhol said success is a job in New York City. And I think that's a more realistic approach to how people should think about their lives. Like, not everyone... It so rarely works out that, you know, that you get the combination of talent, luck, timing, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, why do you think it worked for you?
I have no idea.
It just
truly,
did.
Truly have no idea. I think I would say luck is probably the most important.
But you're not saying other people shouldn't try.
No, I think people,
Jonathan's saying is be realistic, you know, follow your dreams and it'll all work out. Sometimes you have to reassess your dreams. And I think so many people today are driven by this desire to be famous. If you look at what people want, it's less that they want fulfilling work that makes them feel gratified. It's more they want to be a quote-unquote brand that makes them famous.
Yes. Thank you. That's totally true. And I think you know, if you can get a job in a field that you're interested in.
And that you enjoy.
Yeah, then that's success. Like, that's hitting it out of the park. And I think that people's expectations have gotten really twisted and unrealistic.
On a related note, Jonathan, you also said that high self-esteem is the enemy of creativity. Can you talk more about that? I thought that was really interesting.
I think creativity is a very strange and challenging beast to explain. And Simon calls me Ariana Kafka because he says that half of me is like kind of a glib, fun, like kicky pop songstress like Ariana Grande. And that's the sort of dreamy side of me in which ideas first occur. Like I might wake up one day and say, I know, I want to make a gigantic lucite foot in pink lucite. And that's sort of an Ariana Grande dreamy kind of world. But in order to take that idea and turn it into a real thing, one has to be intensely like self-critical and analytical and have very low self-esteem. And so you see the first...
And perfectionistic.
You have to be very perfectionistic. You need to look at the first sample and say, that sucks, like me. I'm the worst. This is the worst. Why? And then you need to sort of torture it into its best self. So I think to be creatively successful, you need to have a strange combination of dreamy, high self-esteem to come up with an idea and extremely analytical, intense, low self-esteem to torture the idea.
It.
Yeah, to execute it and make it as good as it can be.
Does your polo shirt say Jap on it, by the way?
It does. That's my monogram.
Oh, wow. We should, know, this refers to Jewish American princess generally, not the racist description of Japanese people.
Right.
To be clear.
Yes, no, but I happen to have a monogram that is Jap.
Well, wait, Jonathan
Paul Adler.
Oh.
And you're...
Jonathan Paul Adler, get it. I'm curious, do you make everything that you sell in the store? Do you design everything you sell in the store?
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple exceptions. Like, we sell a couple different artists' work and stuff. But, yeah, I work in every medium and kind of design
furniture,
and make...
Furniture, everything, lamps,
furniture, lighting,
rugs.
Yeah. Everything.
I really like the vase with the breasts all over it.
Merci. Yeah, that's that is from my
Muse collection.
I really
like it.
It's
a
good
one. Do you have one?
Yeah, I don't.
Oh,
I have to go by the store.
I know what to get you for Christmas.
Yeah. No, a lot of my friends have it and they're different, but I like the one that has sort of the breasts all over it.
Yeah.
It's too bad you all are missing Katie's gesture right now, by the way.
Yeah, she's mimicking breasts. You don't actually...
Well, she's mimicking grabbing breasts.
Yeah, this would be... It's an
well, they're
this would
cute
take
little breasts. That's what I kind of
she's
like
starting
about
again.
It.
By the way, before we wrap, we should talk about the new challenge you've taken on, Simon. You're a judge on a reality show because, of course, why not? And it's called Making It. And it's hosted by Amy Poehler and Nick Offerman, who are two hilarious people. And I hope they're hilarious with each other, too, although they're not a couple.
No, they're not a couple.
Yeah. Anyway.
Are they? No, because
no.
Nick Offerman is with
Megan
Mullally.
But I bet they're a hilarious couple.
Yes.
Anyway, can you explain how the show works?
Yeah, it's a crafting competition show or crafting competition show. I am one of two judges. I'm an expert judge. The other judge is Dana Isom Johnson from Etsy. And Nick and Amy are the hosts. And, you know, crafts is something that Amy Poehler is passionate about, as is Nick. Even though she doesn't do them herself, she feels that they are the solution to all our problems. We all need to put down our devices and start decoupaging and macrameing. And it is a national movement, the crafting movement. And I think that's why the show is such a big hit. It's also 100% positive. I mean, the first day on the set, she said, I don't want any fake conflict, any bitchiness, any blah, blah, blah. And I said, we'll see you later. But no, from the get-go, it was all going to be about positivity. And as you say, I think people need that right now. And that's one of the reasons it's a big hit. So it was so fun to do, though, because for me, it's like being back in the display studio, chicken wire props, decoupage, mod podge, making stuff. Yeah, it was a great experience, something unexpected.
So tell me about decorating the White House, Simon. Was that the thrill of a lifetime?
Decorating the White House was the thrill of a lifetime. I had just become a citizen and voted for Barack Obama. And I thought, I'm here. I'm American. And then Desiree Rogers, who was the social secretary, she called me and said, we want help with the holiday decor. And that was right at the beginning of the year. And I spent that year going back and forward. And I worked with this wonderful florist called Kimberly Merlin. So it was very much, you know, I was very involved in it. And but there was a group of us working on it and a ton of volunteers. It actually really looked great. I mean, I don't think it's ever looked better, of course. We incorporated recycling elements, and Mrs. Obama was, I had two meetings with her, and it was, she was just so lovely and so kind to everybody. And she threw a little party for all the volunteers after the installation was complete. And I just remember her extemporaneous speech was just so perfect. And yeah, it was a great experience.
That's so fun. I mean, how are you all dealing with the current political climate? I can't help but listen to that story and wonder what it would be like to decorate the current White House.
What would you do if you were decorating the current White House, Simon?
Oh, my God, the mind reels. Fortunately, I haven't been
Would you take
upon.
That job if you were called?
I don't think so. You know, I think he should just do what he does at Trump Tower, that gaudy kind of Roman casino Caesar's Palace look that they have going on. Do that. Like, no. I tend to sort of... I'm so busy with these book projects. I don't obsess about the political world. I voted for Hillary Clinton. I was disappointed. But, you know, when you're in retail, time goes by really quickly. You know, our holiday campaigns, we used to plan 2 years out. You know, so I'm very used to thinking ahead and thinking of when there'll be a new person in there, you know.
You know, the coverage is so relentless. And if you're in our business, it's hard not to feel like you're absolutely drowning in this constant slew of drama and negativity and tumult. So it's inescapable, I think, for people like us. But what about you, Jonathan?
I travel a lot for work. Like, I am in Asia quite often. I've traveled all around the world, the Middle East, South America. And whenever I come back to America, I am always like, wow, America's pretty great. This sounds, you know, grand, but I'm lucky
media.
To have sort of a global perspective. And, you know, I appreciate that we're a democracy. I think that whenever I come back to America, I feel really happy to be here. I'm a huge America lover. And I think, you know, it's a fascinating time to be alive, but I'm a busy guy. I don't think the political situation has made me mad one way or another. I find it interesting, but I'm always happy to be here.
I can
but
hear I, people listening to this, though, and wondering, as two gay men, are you outraged by sort of what you see as perhaps a lack of tolerance for diversity and a lack of openness for, you know,
well, the decision to kick transgender people
right,
out of the military.
Well, right, or, yeah. You know, sort of otherizing people in general.
I think that, you know, one should always kind of keep one's eye on that situation and strive for greater rights and parity. But again, I always think about the journey from my childhood when I lived in rural America. Being gay was an impossibility. And think about how lucky I am to be alive today. And again, when I travel the world in places where I've been to places where it's illegal to be gay, it's always a good reminder to me how lucky, you know, are things perfect here? Of course not. Oh, my God, things are not perfect. But I'm awfully glad to be here versus some other places.
I do think that's a healthy reminder that in the grand sweep of history, we are so much better off than we were even 20 or 30 years ago.
Oh, my God.
And people kind of take that for granted. And it's easy to lose sight of that in the day-to-day relentless coverage.
Yeah, but in fairness, I think people are worried about turning back the clock and some of the rights.
Oh, my God, that's
you know, the progress that's been made is going to be reversed, and they want to stay ever vigilant on that. And so I appreciate that point of view as
well. Well, we went through that. You know, we got married in that window when it was legalized.
In 2004.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden, Prop 8 was upheld by a referendum and we were unmarried. We weren't married again. So, you know, to go through that, you have to like, okay, tomorrow's another day, Scarlett O'Hara, you know, pull the carrot out of the dirt. You keep going because, and then in typical American way, it did eventually get sorted out and Edie Windsor came along and then it was...
Well, and we should provide maybe a little bit more context for people who weren't in that. In 2004, in San Francisco, gay marriage was legalized. This became a huge national issue. It was an issue in the presidential campaign that year that George W. Bush used successfully to get reelected. The voters of California, progressive, liberal California, voted to ban gay marriage in 2008, invalidating your relationship. And then 7 years after that, the Supreme Court legalized gay marriage nationally.
Brian, so that's quite a...
I know. Thank you for that. Her story.
That was so good.
Sorry. That was good.
But that's quite a journey, and maybe hopefully a metaphor for progress writ large.
Weirdly for us, it wasn't an emotional journey, because I think we've both been through, I remember the legalization of homosexuality in 1967, the Wolfenden Report, blah, blah, blah. So I've been through all these vicissitudes. And, you know, as a creative person, you stay focused, you hope for the best. And, you know, there are incredible people in the gay movement, like the people at the HRC who doggedly stuck with it, and Edie Windsor, as I mentioned before, and they made it happen. They brought it back to the Supreme Court, which you could probably say a lot better than me, because yes, you're Brian Pedia.
I interviewed James Obergefell.
Oh, wow.
Who was the man really behind that Supreme Court decision. And it's so interesting to me how changing the perspective and really referring to it as marriage equality,
yes,
really actually had a lot to do with greater acceptance of gay marriage.
Yeah.
Absolutely, it's 100%.
Now, seeing the journey of the way other people perceive gay marriage has been so fascinating, because it took people within the gay world a while to even come around to the idea of it. And I think actually AIDS had a huge impact on the gay marriage movement, because during the AIDS epidemic, during its height, a lot of people would die and their longtime companions would lose everything they had because they weren't legally entitled to it. And I think a lot of people didn't realize
that. I think that's why Edie Windsor got involved, right?
Yeah.
That happened to her.
Well, it happened to her. Yes, a similar thing. It wasn't AIDS, but similar thing.
You couldn't give money to your spouse.
Yes. And I think
her partner was dying, right?
And her partner for whom she was like a longtime caregiver, the partner I think had MS and eventually ended up in a wheelchair. And it was like a very sad and inspiring love story. And I think a lot of straight people didn't really understand the financial implications of the lack of gay marriage. You know, they didn't really understand that if somebody's longtime partner died, they would owe taxes in a way that straight couples wouldn't. And I think that when you put it into real nitty-gritty dollar and cents terms, and people are much more sympathetic to it because they kind of understand the real implications beyond just sort of a conceptual
Did being thing. Married feel different to you guys than being in the relationship before that?
Nope.
No, we're like two
we always
blokes.
Felt
we're very
married.
We're sort of not the most sentimental people. I'm glad you told me when the dates of gay marriage legalization were, because neither of us has any idea when we got married. So now I know it was between 2004 and 2008.
Do you remember the date?
Nope. But, you know, my parents got married in a registry office, and they went to the pub next door, and they got paralytically drunk and lost the marriage certificate. So they never knew when they were married, and they never had a wedding anniversary.
So you never celebrate your anniversary?
Nope.
Well, I think, you know what, we're very celebratory about our lives.
We're
like this weekend,
lucky.
We're out paddle boarding. How lucky are we? Look at the weather. Look at the dog. Hello, you're cute. Blah, blah, blah. Like, we don't take anything for granted, but it's those things.
You celebrate every day.
Yeah, but neither
exactly.
of us.
Exactly. We're lucky to have such great lives.
And you know? Neither of us is terribly sentimental, but I will tell you, like, I went to Brown in the late 80s, and somehow all of my friends were these like super fancy heiresses. And so after college, Simon, like,
sounds awful.
When I first, well, it's kind of, there's a reason I'm saying this. So when Simon first met me, we went to about 10 weddings in a row that each one was more extravagant and glamorous than the last, of these like heiress after heiress getting married, and they were billion-dollar ceremonies, blah. They're all divorced. Every single one of them is divorced.
Wow.
So, you know, I think there is a little bit of a lesson there. Like, Slyman and I had a very low-key wedding, and we are blissfully, happily together, lo these however many years it's been later.
Ten.
years later.
If you feel it, because for a lot of people, you know, that we have a lot of events in our lives, as do you. Events. You live in New York. It's always some bloody thing going on. For a lot of people, the wedding is, that's the big thing that they're always going to remember. And the zhush and the flowers and the why not, if that's, you know, so no, I don't have an opinion about it. It's entirely a personal thing, whether you do that or not.
So after watching so many people around you break up, what do you think is the secret to your success?
I think we have a common sense of humor, and our parents are weirdly similar. Like our sensibility, we tend to laugh at the same thing, you know, make fun of each other, tease.
I think humor is so important. And yeah, even if just one person in the couple is funny, and I think you both are funny, and I would like to say in my marriage, we're both, I think, pretty funny, but it's also the ability to appreciate the other person's sense of humor, which is really, really important.
You know, you Mulder's have to. Very funny. Oh, and he's I think hilarious. Sometimes you're funny too.
He thinks I'm funny. I think he's funny. And that's when I think most duos really work, when there's a joint appreciation of each other.
It's not a common thing. You know, the other night I was in a restaurant and I was looking, there was a group of guys together and they're all roaring with laughter and drinking. A group of girls after work screaming with laughter, like throwing things at each other, having such a great time. And then a couple, a man and woman together, and they look like they're very anxious with each other.
Maybe, you know, it was a first date.
Yeah. And I thought, oh, well, hopefully that loosens up a bit. Because when you do go out and you see a man and a woman together and they're laughing and joking, it's the nicest thing to see. You think, oh, yeah, look, that's a rapport right there.
I used to always look at couples in restaurants. And if they weren't talking to each other, I'd say it to my husband. My first husband passed away. And so I would say, hey, if we ever turn out like those people, I'm going to be so depressed because they're not even speaking to one another. But I've actually come around because I think there's something really nice occasionally, not all the time, about being able to be quiet with someone too, that not feeling like you have to entertain each other all the time and just sort of being comfortable.
Like me on the first date.
Not on the first bloody date.
No,
on the
I agree.
First date, bring
no,
it.
No, of course not on the first date. I mean to get to that point.
All right, but I just need to kick it back to us. On that first date, my God, was he mute. You should thank me every day, Slimen, that I was the chatty Kathy that I am, and now 20... Something?
By the way, we just got an alert from the control room. We just figured out that your 10-year wedding anniversary is actually tomorrow. Did you know
what?
This? It's tomorrow.
Thank you.
September
what are you getting
18th?
Me? September 18th.
Yes.
10 years. All right. We'll be sure to not celebrate that.
I think Jonathan has this beautiful vase that's covered with breasts.
Yeah.
That has your name on it.
Yeah. What are you getting me? But yeah, it is interesting why... Lo, these many years later, why we still are such a happy couple. And to be honest, I would never say this IRL, just a duh, but I never tire of seeing my Simon's face. I'm always happy to see that
He's
little
so
face.
Cute too.
Simon and Jonathan, it's been so fun to talk to you, and actually for me to get to know you both a little bit better. And happy anniversary. I'm sure you'll celebrate it in style if you remember. But just again, it's tomorrow.
Oh, good to know. Good to know.
That's incredible.
And thank you so much for coming by and being on the podcast. We really appreciate it and really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. We had a great time.
That does it for our first ever couples episode. Thank you to our team at Stitcher, our producer Gianna Palmer, associate producer Nora Ritchie, Andy Christens, who engineered this episode. Grazie, Andy. She's very cute. That's Andy with an I, and she's a female. And Jared O'Connell, who mixed this episode. And of course, my assistant Beth DeMaz, and my new digital guru, Julia Lewis.
Mark Phillips wrote our theme music. Katie Couric and I are the show's executive producers. If you'd like to keep the conversation going, find us on social media. I tweet from @GoldsmithB, and Katie is all over the place on Instagram under Katie Couric.
Check out my stories, people, if you want to be amused. Meanwhile, we'll be back next week, for real this time, because we have no choice, with the first installment in our documentary series, looking back at our interviews from 10 years ago with vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin.
Talk to you then.
Hey everyone, it's Katie Couric, and I want to tell you about one of my new favorite podcasts. It's called A Really Good Cry with the amazing Roddy Devlukia, a plant-based chef, entrepreneur, and now a podcast host who will guide you through a journey of self-discovery, one tear at a time. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Roddy Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go, right? There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. On NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's part existential deep dive and part game show. I ask actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to ask some of life's biggest questions. Listen to NPR's Wildcard on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast, and I had the opportunity to talk to one of Hollywood's major icons, Michael B. Jordan. In our conversation, Michael shares the highs, the lows, and everything in between, offering a genuine glimpse into his world.
The closest to getting what you want is always the hardest. People give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.